you just tuned into the hippest way to start and grow your indie author career. Learn the ins, the outs, and all the all-arounds of self-publishing with the team from D2D and their industry-influencing guests. You're listening to Self-Publishing Insiders with Draft2Digital. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. I'm going to have a real good time with this particular D2D spotlight today because I'm talking to my good friend, Mal Cooper. We call her Mal around these parts. We never asked her permission. But I'd like to welcome you to the show, Mal. So thanks for popping in and chatting with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I always love talking with you, Kevin.
Yeah, we have a good time. Now, you and I met several years ago now at Indie Book Fest in Orlando. Orlando, right? Okay. And we've been friends ever since. I'm not going to quote the inscription because it uses adult themed pornography. Not pornography. adult themed language. You have to throw the word pornography around every now and then so that people pay attention.
There you go.
But
like adult themed pornography as opposed to adult themed?
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of implications to that should be considered before I ever use that phrase again. You had written in your Facebook ads book, you are not a expletive deleted unicorn. And it's still one of my favorite sign-offs from an author. So there you go. So we're going to get into a whole bunch of stuff in this. First, I want to tell everybody that if you're watching, please feel free to ask questions in the comments. We are going to take comments and questions live in the last 15 minutes of the broadcast. And I'm sure Mal will have plenty to say to answer your questions. So feel free. And starting now, though, let's chat a little bit about, because we're going to talk some of the things that you pitched I really like. Productivity is one that I think authors are going to get a lot of mileage out of. Mm-hmm. Branding is something I don't think we've talked about before. And of course, we're going to talk about your work. So, sure. But let's kind of start there, actually, because I want to know, like, you and I, in all our conversations, I don't think we've ever talked about how you got started and, you know, what your process is or what Aeon 14 means or any of that.
Sure. So,
how'd you get started?
I'll take it from the top. So I, like a lot of authors, I puttered around with writing for years. I tried to write my first book when I was like 10 or 11 years old, and I still have it somewhere, and I'm terrified to look at it because I'm sure it's garbage. But I'd always sort of grown up on a fantasy. And after watching the movie The Serenity and the Firefly series, I thought maybe I should try my hand at science fiction because I'd always liked reading science fiction. And I really like science fiction that paid a lot of attention to the facts and making sure that things were consistent and whatnot. And you could tell that if something happened in a certain way, it was going to be guaranteed to happen that way again because the author really understood their world. So I set out to do that. And I wrote a book back in like 2008, or maybe 2007 actually is when it was done. And I tried querying it and all that stuff and found that it didn't work. But I also realized that to write a sequel, I would need to know more about the characters. So I decided to write this prequel story. And in the process of writing that prequel story, while I did that, my wife, Jill, published a couple of books on Kindle, on this crazy new weird Kindle thing. And shortly after she did that, I decided to take the new book I had just written called OutSystem and publish that on Kindle as well. And I did everything wrong. I could talk for like an hour and a half about all the things I did wrong. But the end result was that it didn't sell any books for like 4 years.
Yeah.
And on the fourth year in 2016, because that one came out in 2012. So in 2016, Jill actually started doing Facebook ads for the book. We finally got the book in front of the right audience and the thing took off. It sat in the top 1000 on Amazon for longer than 6 months. So that sort of like kicked off my career. And I've always done a lot of work in advertising, both building platforms from a software standpoint and actually working with companies to help them advertise. And what I realized is that if I just write this one series, I'm going to be advertising the same book for 7 years. Mm-hmm. So I decided, and I looked at what a bunch of other authors were doing at the time, and what the long-term successful authors had done, and I realized that the ones who really stuck around had a backlist, and they were consistent. So exactly. I basically set out to build a massive backlist so that eventually I could kind of relax and whether the ups and downs everybody always says we have in this industry.
That is a good that's a good point, by the way, and it's well articulated, because I've tried to get that idea across to people before, and I don't think I even I did not quite consider it that way.
All right,
backer is kind of your buffer that you don't have to constantly, you know, lay tracks in front of the train.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that kind of how you see it too?
Yeah, you can. I don't advertise all the books in my backlist all the time. I kind of rotate through them, so I can make it look like I can make a new audience, you know, in for Facebook ads that I haven't advertised a particular series to before, and basically make it look like I'm launching a new series to these people.
Yeah.
And now that I have 24 series, I can do that all the time.
Yeah. Are you do you refresh your covers, or do you just pretty much stick with the
cover as released? So I had some of my earlier books have been through like three or four covers.
Yeah.
And I've now refreshed, I think I've brought all of them up to a sort of a new standard. All the covers I have right now, barring like maybe six or seven, are done by Andrew Dobell.
Yeah.
And most of them are with custom photo shoots and whatnot. So my models are consistent across all the covers, and no one else is using these models and stuff like that, which is really nice. Yeah. And I do every now and then change out the book once.
Yeah.
I'll do a new cover for those, but the rest of them, once they're set, I kind of just leave them. Maybe in 5 or 6 years, I might do it again.
I was always impressed by the fact that you went to that length, and because I keep threatening to do that, I've done shoots, I've used models for things in the past, but never for my covers. Mm. So I love the idea, but it's like that it's a lot of work. People don't realize how much work that is.
Yeah. And I think that, like, if you count, because I had like custom costumes and everything made for these models, I think that probably all told, I spend about $20,000 on shoots, maybe even more, because I've done 5 or 6 shoots now. And then I got a whole whack of covers redone as well that probably cost me about $10,000. So
yeah,
it's not a cheap endeavor to do that sort of thing.
No, it's the kind of thing you're going to want to do if you are already basically seeing some success with it, or if you have, you just happen to have 20 or 30 grand laying around that you don't need.
Might as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way I am.
Yeah. Here. One thing I do think though, is I don't think that covers, a lot of people, they think that like just by changing their cover, they're going to see instant success, but that's not the way it really works.
That's not true. Right.
If you do that, you have to do like a whole relaunch, and it's your relaunch that gives you success. But yeah, just a cover alone, for me, a lot of it was that I'm like really particular about things matching, which is why I recovered so many. Like these, the new ones and the old ones have to match. So
yeah. No, I agree. That's the cover won't necessarily dictate your success, but it could hamper your success for sure.
True.
Yeah. But it might help too, in that at least, you know, that's one of the reasons why I almost always refresh covers, like about once every 2 years at this point. I think I refresh my covers at least slightly. Because it does, you know, it makes them seem new.
Yeah.
So now that's impressive. Now you, I want to ask you, I've always wanted to ask you, and I always seem to forget, but why Aeon 14? What's the significance of that name for your series?
So as I started digging into, one of the things I did before I started writing this sci-fi universe is I spent 2 years researching astronomy. Okay. And building out local star charts and figuring out how long it would take to travel between different stars with different modes of propulsion and stuff like that. And one of the things I found that was really neat is I was always kind of curious is how do we know the universe is 13.8 billion years old? Yeah. And there's this thing called the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is basically the echo of the Big Bang. It's actually the stuff that causes static on your television, if you remember when televisions had static on them.
Yeah.
And it's uniformly spread across the universe, which is why they came up with a theory of the Big Bang, which has been since replaced with the waveform theory, which is basically still a Big Bang, but doesn't have time at the beginning. It's the one that Stephen Hawking came up with. But anyway, when I learned about that, and I was sort of just going through all that research, and I discovered that that astronomers refer to an aeon, A-E-O-N, as a billion years.
Okay.
So if the universe is 13.8 billion years old, we're in aeon 14.
Okay. All right. There you go.
Yeah, the other thing I did with it too is I wanted a name that I could brand that no one else was going to use, and that when anyone heard of it, they would know it's these books by this author.
Yes. Now that brings us all the way around to branding, which you said you were willing to talk about, and you do this very well. So where do you start with building a brand? Like, how can authors get into this and do this right?
Well, the very first thing like that I wanted to do when I wrote that first book, OutSystem, and published it in 2012, I was kind of audacious. I put on the cover of that book, I put an Aeon 14 novel. It was the only Aeon 14 novel and was for right. like 2.5 years. But yeah. I put that on there because I wanted to make it seem like this was part of a big thing. And I wanted to make it so that I could start getting that name into people's minds, you know, that there's this universe called Aeon 14. I drew that kind of like from Forgotten Realms and Dragonlance
right.
and other things like that that I had read when I was younger, that you could just like walk in and see books with like this logo on it or this name on it. You knew that was going to be something you were going to like and you could pick it up.
Yeah, I'm kind of stealing. Well, I'm not stealing. I mean, I'm doing something similar. And I'm actually rebranding my existing series under a new banner. So mm-hmm. I'm watching to see what you do and what you have done so I can steal ideas from you.
Of course. Why not?
So are there some best practices people? I mean, I did, by the way, something very similar on my first when I was still writing sci-fi, that first novel I released. I put I didn't put a brand on it, but I put book one of three,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, or the first book in the trilogy or something similar. And I regretted it for like the next 10 years, but because I had to write the other two books, that was pre book a month days for me.
Right, right.
So
writing was hard and stuff.
Writing
like that.
Once, yeah. Isn't it weird how suddenly writing it's still hard, but it's like it became more manageable all of a sudden.
Yeah. It becomes like after you do it enough, it just becomes like a faucet you can turn on and off.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like I'm writing now and you just do it.
A faucet that drains your soul.
it does come from somewhere. Yes. It
has to come from somewhere. So what are some maybe best practices authors can keep in mind as they are developing a brand?
Well, I think you might want to do it two ways. A lot of off, like I'm writing I deliberately decide to write everything in one universe, which I call Aeon 14. So every book that I have that's out, barring one, which I wrote on commission for a video game, mm-hmm. Is all in the Aeon 14 universe. And I did that because I did a bunch of research on series read through with authors and found that there's not as much read through from one series to the next, even if they're in the same genre. Right. But from what I could tell, and this was from talking to a lot of folks like Michael Anderle and whatnot, who were sort of trailblazing, writing a whole ton of novels in one universe, that they were getting a much better read through between series when everything was in one universe. And you see the same thing with like Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, like, oh, Spider-Man's going to be in this one. I'll go watch that one. You know, they do all sorts of things to make sure that you want to watch every movie to get the whole story, but they can still sort of treat each one as its own property and run its own timeline. And so that's kind of what I ended up doing is that I created this universe big enough to tell every story I'm ever going to want to write. And I was able to put all that into one universe. The difference, not every author can do that or wants to do that. And so in those cases, you have to build more of a brand around your name. And there's even some really basic things in there. Like my name is the same font and the same size on every single book I have.
Yeah.
And there's lots of little things like that. So people are like, is this the same MD Cooper? They're like, yep, it looks totally familiar. It's obviously the same MD Cooper. Whereas I see a lot of authors that are totally inconsistent with their author names. And if they try like a new thing or they maybe do a different style of cover, you could imagine there might be some reader confusion. So you want to do all the little things to make sure that you don't create barriers to entry anywhere with the readers.
Yeah. I learned that lesson. It took a while to learn that. I think every book I released, I tried to do a different theme for the, you know, for the copy on the cover and everything, because in my head, and I think a lot of authors fall in, is I want to make them distinct, right? It's a different series, but people are going to follow me, and which is not true. People don't necessarily follow the author.
They don't.
Yeah.
But you do want to make it as clear as possible, you know, that you are that same author.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why I think with my covers, if any of you guys look up MD Cooper online and you look at my covers, you'll be able to look at any cover in the future and say like, that's an MD Cooper cover. You'll be able to tell.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's definitely good branding. So are you doing the thing? So this is what I've been shifting toward is writing under I mentioned this earlier. I've created a Historic Crimes is the name of the overarching brand, right? And I have my Kotler books that I'm going to put under that. So I'm shifting them, but then I can I'm stealing this from Anderle and his bunch. Like, I want to be able to write other books besides right. Dan Collar books. So if I put them all under this banner, people will see them as maybe being the same series and follow through.
Yeah. That kind of idea. You're creating a universe effectively.
Exactly. Without,
and now I'm curious about this. Are they all in the same universe? Like, could they everything. Functionally be in the same universe?
So one thing I did write from the very beginning is every single book I write, even the sci-fi and fantasy stuff, is linked. Like there's an Easter egg at least that links every book. And if you're really diligent about it, and I encourage you readers, go try, buy every book. But if you're really diligent about it, you can find a path from every one book to the other throughout the entire thing. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I could make that happen. So that's fun. But we're not here to talk about me. In terms of branding, I mean, we talk about, you know, making sure that your, you know, typography is the same between books. Your covers have changed from time to time, but they're pretty consistent in terms of how they look. You're just iterating and improving over time, right?
Well, I mean, my very early stuff was quite a bit different, but everything probably since about late 2017 has been the style that it is now. And I do some things where I will actually have individual books in a series will have one style and omnibuses will have another style. So one of the big things in science fiction is always a debate between pew-pew starships and characters pew-pewing, because some people want the big story of a character or of a starship and the epic plot, and some people want to see certain characters kicking butt. Yeah. And so what I do, pardon me, is if the individual titles have characters on them, the omnibuses all have ships, and vice versa. If the individual books have ships, then the omnibuses will all have characters. Yeah. And that way I can I can target those different people who might like different things with the same books. And I use omnibuses a lot to do that. Some of my titles are like in seven different collections.
Oh, that's
right. I'm trying to get different titles out, marketed different ways with different kinds of art and stuff like that to try and catch people where they are.
Are you, do you distribute wide?
I was for a while and I ended up having to stop for two reasons. One of them was that, I should take a step back. When I went wide with about 40 books. And they were making more money wide than they were making KU in Amazon. Mm-hmm. So I was actually able to offset and even improve upon what I was doing in Amazon with KU. Profit-wise, they were a little bit lower because I had to advertise for each of those retailers. But it still wasn't that bad. The thing that ended up really hitting me was that the books I left in KU were performing worse and worse in KU. Right. And so I did a little bit of surveying and I checked my reviews and whatnot. And what I discovered was that KU readers were realizing this was one big universe, seeing that half of it wasn't in KU anymore and just deciding not to read any of it. So I'm sort of in this unique situation that until I get sort of this whole thing, because I promised my readers that I would finish it in KU. The people that started with me way back. So I need to wrap it up. And then I might investigate at that point, taking the whole thing wide.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand those challenges. I'm not going to boot you out of our D2D spotlight for that. I have a series that's in KU, so it's, you know, and the same challenges apply. You were going to say something. I'm sorry.
My throat is just giving up on me here. My nonfiction is wide, so I do have some books with D2D. So.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. You've redeemed yourself.
Yay!
Let's talk a little bit about the way you handle productivity in your writing. Let's start with the basics. Like do you write daily? Do you, you stick to a schedule? How do you do it?
So I advocate that people write daily and I don't always do it myself. But it's still aspirational for me to write every day.
Yeah.
And I believe that that's probably the number one way that authors can increase their productivity is to write every day, even if it's just a little bit.
Yeah.
Because if you write every day, you're keeping it fresh in your mind. Mm-hmm. And then when you start up, you don't need to read as much. You'd be like, okay, I remember where everything left off. And you just keep going again. And the other thing that I find really helpful when I'm trying to really keep everything going every single day is I never end my daily writing at the end of a scene. I end it right in the middle of a scene, like someone just yelled something at someone or someone just got their head blown off or something like that. And I drop some bullet points about what's going to be next. And that way it doesn't take me that long to get myself back into it. I'm like, what's going to happen? Well, obviously this character is going to do X, Y, Z. So I have them do that. Whereas if I'm starting fresh with a whole new scene, I'm like, you know, what am I doing? So,
yeah. Who was it that did? There was a classic, I think probably an American lit author who, was it Hemingway or I don't know.
I don't know.
I remember reading that somewhere that was advice. Like they'd get to the end of a page, and wherever the sentence ended on that page, that's where they stopped. And
I have heard of that. Yeah, I think it might have been Hemingway.
Might have been.
Or the guy who wrote Tom Sawyer. What's his name?
Mark Twain.
That guy.
Samuel Clemens. The guy who wrote Tom Sawyer. What's his name?
I think I've been having really bad shoulder pain, and I've only been sleeping for 2 to 3 hours a night. So
you don't have to. You don't have to give me excuses.
I'm Canadian.
You're Canadian. We weren't thinking about Tom Sawyer, the great American novel. That was like
we only had half a year of American literature in Canada. Come on, give me a break.
Yeah. So same in Texas, by the way. It's all Texas literature. Everything's Texas. We have our own history curriculum, like our own, right? Okay. So that's cool. So how do you? Are you a Potter or are you a Panzer?
I'm a Panzer.
Okay, me too. We've talked about this, and I think I don't remember if you felt the same way I did. I always feel like I'm doing everything wrong when I talk to other authors and their plotters. Like I feel like maybe I'm a fraud because they're writing real books and I'm just making stuff up.
It's funny because for me, writing a book is like reading a book. I don't know what's going to happen next, and it's exciting and fun. I've tried doing full plots for books before, and I get bored, and I don't finish the book, or I have to throw out the plot and mess everything up. I have to throw a monkey in the wrench to get interested in it again.
Right.
But I also look at how much some people plot, and I'm like, that's a lot of time, and those are a lot of words you wrote in that plot. That could have been a book.
That's what I always say. It's like, well, if you're going to spend that kind of time and get to that level of detail, why didn't you just write the book? It's the exact same experience. People disagree with me on that, but I say it's the same. I've tried plotting. Mm-hmm. And what I ended up doing, so what I did was borrow from my film and TV days, where I would do like a treatment,
mm-hmm.
and I'd try to do an outline, or even use like index cards and things like that. And then I found that I was filling in all the gaps as I was creating it. So really all I had to do was copy and paste it over into the book. I was writing the book anyway. So I'm not convinced that there is such a distinction as plotter and pantser now. I think we're all exactly the same. So do you do anything fancy to track? What do you write in? What software do you
prefer? I write in Word. I'm a Word girl. I do my formatting in Word, my print is in Word, ebook, everything's in Word.
I respect that.
Yeah.
I don't like script. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You?
Why is that?
I spent most of my career as a copywriter. So Microsoft Word is like your tool. That's what you use. So when I started writing fiction, I first tried using Word, wrote my first like 3 books in Word, but I found it to be more stressful because I was in the same environment I was in all day.
Right.
The shifting to Scrivener helped me shift my brain into a whole new mode. So
that makes a lot of sense. I like that. Yeah.
But go ahead. I interrupted you.
That's which okay.
is not supposed to do that.
That's right. I'm doing a lot of books. There's been times where I've been up to a book a week. I'm not doing that anymore because it was just too draining, but it allowed me to build that massive backlist where right now I can release a book a month and do quite a bit better. In fact, like I'm making in 2018, I was releasing a book a week, and I'm at about half the monthly revenue now that I was in 2018, but I'm doing one quarter of the work, so I'm counting that as a win.
It definitely is.
But I like using Word because when I'm doing that many books, I don't want extra steps. I want my production process to be really fast, so I actually write the book in Word with Word already formatted for print. So I'm actually seeing exactly what this book's going to look like when it's printed out. And then when I take that exact same copy and I upload it to KDP for ebook and they strip everything out. And because I'm using a Word-based table of contents and everything like that, it all just magically works.
Yeah.
And I don't have to, I mean, there's like some tiny difference between the print and the ebook. Mainly that I just have to remove the underlines on links and that's really it.
Yeah. When I first started, I used Word for everything. I used the for layout, and I got made fun of for that by Nick Thacker, who was like, you know, at least use InDesign or something. But no, Microsoft Word does it all. So.
Yeah. And the other thing I find, especially for new authors, is don't spend, I mean, when I, one of the things that really drove it home for me was there were some authors at the very beginning of like the 2016 wave of indie publishing,
right?
Where a lot of people started getting really big. They were terrible at formatting.
Right.
They had paragraphs in different fonts, you know, and stuff like that. Like it was horrible. And they were making bank. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, that kind of proves to you that, you know, a genre reader, a pulp reader, doesn't really care about all that stuff. So you spend all this time and energy and money on software,
yeah,
and you know, days to release a book when you're going through the formatting and whatnot, and you didn't have to do any of that.
No, that's true. I mean, there's always going to be those readers who complain about the way it looks, you know, or turned off by it. But no, man, if you've got, especially in sci-fi, like the stuff you write, you could write that thing in crayon and people are going to read every word of it.
It's true. Yeah. Yeah. They don't want frills at all. No. My big thing is I'm consistent. All of my books are formatted the same and look the same, and they're neat and tidy. They're not sloppy or messy or anything. Like I'm pretty anal. Like when I work with co-authors, I'm like, you used the wrong font when you added a blank line after the chapter title. Like I'm like that particular, cause I want the spacing to be precise and whatnot, but I have all that stuff just with the styles and words. So it's no extra work really.
This is why I rarely co-author, by the way, because of people like you who are going to give me grief because my fonts don't match.
Well, I only did it to something after like five or six books. For the first couple of books, I just kept my mouth shut and took care of it.
It's an automatic. You can just highlight and change it. It's not like it's not going
to
break.
I can, but it'd be nice if I didn't have to.
Because you're avoiding extra steps.
Exactly. That's part of your productivity. I don't want more steps. It's
how do you handle editing?
So I have an editor who also works in Word. Mm-hmm. We do everything in Office 365, which I guess as of like yesterday is now Microsoft 365.
Yeah.
And so everything's stored in the cloud. And once I get to about halfway to three quarters of the way through the book, I'll do a second pass through the book. Usually because at that point I have some sort of brilliant idea about how the book's actually going to end. And I need to go and put some foreshadowing and clean up some prior things. Yeah. So I hit that point and I then say, you can start editing this book. And while I'm writing the last quarter of the book, she's editing the first three quarters of the book. Okay. And she's usually like nipping at my heels by the end. and if I need to go back and change anything, I just said like, hey, I have to go change this page. Can you just give that another run through and she'll do that. But typically I'll be uploading a book about 30 or 40 minutes after she's done editing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a whole, what I call my edit stack. So it's much more or less too elaborate for you, Mal. It's not, you're never going to get on board with my process. I can already tell.
I do actually have a second pass and beta and proofers that go through it as well.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's handy. I mean, how have you found working with the, with like a beta team or proofer team?
So what I do, once that first edit is done, I take the book and I put it up on BookFunnel and I send out a link to all my proofers. At the same time, my editor starts her second pass.
Okay.
Cause typically what happens is when I go through the first editing pass, I make new mistakes. She'll catch a lot of those, but the proofers also catch an extra bit. And the second pass, I'm a lot more meticulous, making sure that if I do change anything, I don't typo any new stuff I put in. By the time my book gets out, probably about 12 different sets of eyes have been on it. And, but I only give my proofers 3 days to go through a book. They don't get very much time at all. Cause I found if I give them more time, they just don't do it. So if I'm like, it's a race, you know, you got to do it to get in, then more people just pick it up and start doing it.
Do they complain? My group complains. Some of them, not all of them. They're great, but they complain.
If I give them like a 1.5 to 1 day,
right.
I get complaints.
I give them like sometimes a week to 2 weeks, but some of them are very upset by that. They want 30 days, you know?
I mean, they're allowed. What my thing is, my thing with this group, I probably have about 40 or 50 people in the group, is it's on the honor system. You either review or you give me proofing feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do tell them that it'll get in if they're late. It just won't be in for publication.
And they're right. And that's the great thing about self-publishing. We can do that.
Yes.
Whereas there are traditionally published books that have been around since like the 70s that still have the same typos.
Oh, so there's a number of typos in Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh yeah.
They're so bad that you can't actually understand what the sentence is. Like it's like these could no one have fixed this? This is like the 9,000th printing of this book.
It makes you wonder if like KU flags that book whenever. No. Okay, so we're at the 12:30 mark.
All right.
And that means everybody, if you are paying attention, you can ask. Some of you have already asked some questions, so we're going to answer your questions live. Before we do that, we're going to take a moment because I want to throw in a few things. First of all, if I can find the banner, there we go. Make sure you're popping over to. Is this the right URL? Did I get it right?
Right URL. Yep.
Aeon14.com. Pop on over and make sure you subscribe and start buying some books. You want to buy all of Mal's books.
All the books. Only 90 of them. It won't be that bad.
Buy 90 of them at full retail. So now we're gonna kind of get into some of the Q&A. I'll go ahead and hide that for now. Let's see. I got some questions that popped up while we were chatting. First of all, well, I got some comments too. Tori Element always tunes in. Tori, hello. Nice. Hey guys, happy Monday. We have a question from YouTube. According to you, advertising necessary for authors, but will it help every author? And is Facebook ad more effective than any of the other ones?
So I think that the first answer to that is yes. I think in this day and age, you can't sell a product without advertising. Now, whether that advertising is you on the side of a street handing out flyers or it's you doing Facebook ads, you have to do some sort of advertising. There's something to the tune of like 70,000 books coming out every month now.
Right.
And there's just no way for readers to find you unless you're doing some form of advertising.
Right.
There's a lot of grassroots ways of doing advertising, getting in multi-author bundles, working out ways to build up a mailing list and stuff like that. And I recommend a lot of those to authors who are just starting out. Like if you don't know the series is going to take off or something like that, don't go dumping like $10,000 into ads or something crazy like that, because you might not ever get it back. The thing that I like about Facebook is that Facebook is where people spend a lot of time, and there's a lot of them. There's 3.5 billion people that use Facebook, and a lot of users spend hours on Facebook every day, which means they stand a much greater chance of seeing your ad. But Facebook is less of a surefire sell than something like AMS ads are. AMS ads are unlikely to do anything other than sell your book. Whereas like if someone could click on a Facebook ad for your book, and be like, oh, I thought this was going to be a TV show, and just not buy. But on AMS, they're already searching for books, or they're looking at a book page, so they're already in the book mindset. So my experience is that Amazon is less likely to blow your dough and not give you a return. Bad Facebook ads could blow your dough and not give you a return. So it behooves people to understand Facebook pretty well before running ads on it. But like I said, it's the biggest platform with the most people spending the most time.
And you can target very specifically on Facebook, which is very helpful. And they actually give you some information in return, whereas you're not going to get much information at all from Amazon.
I've been down to the point where I was working with this one author, and we were trying to improve her reviews and her sales. Right. And her book was basically vigilante justice. So we only targeted red states. And we improved both her reviews and her bang for a buck on her ads.
Okay.
So
what are you trying to say about us red states, man?
I'm just saying that if you're going to write a story about someone running around and gunning down the bad guys, it's going to go over well and better in a red state.
Okay.
At the very least, you're going to find more gun enthusiasts.
True.
So,
all right. You're just playing the numbers. I get it.
I'm not saying there's anything good or bad either way. It's just marketing. It's just demographics.
Just marketing. Right.
Yeah. In my mind, there's nothing wrong with demographics. They're just reflections of reality.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
I just want to make sure no one else actually thinks I'm.
Nobody thinks that. Nobody thinks that. We got another comment from Tori here. The Aeon research. This is fascinating, Mal. So it is fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. And we had another comment from Dean saying, "We borrow, never steal."
That's right. Yeah. Everything is borrowed.
There is a fine line.
I sometimes people get really anal about like you're running an ad and be like, oh, this sounds like this particular movie. I'm like, which also ripped off this movie, which ripped off this book. Like there are no new ideas, people.
Yeah, I remember
getting in the cultures of giants.
Right. I got a negative review on the first Kotler book saying it was a direct ripoff, they said, of National Treasure. And as if that was the very first instance of an archaeological thriller.
And any sort of gold standard. I mean, I like the movie, but I'm not going to like hold it up as like some sort of like epic thing that, broke new ground or anything.
I even said in like an afterword of the book that that was one of my inspirations, that I enjoyed the film. I like that genre. Yeah. I also said Indiana Jones, by the way, and Clive Cussler novels. Mm-hmm. So nobody, they didn't think to slight me on that. So which one do you strongly suggest, KU or Wide with D to D? Uh-oh. Let me hover over this ban button.
I'm morally and ethically opposed and future-proofingly opposed to Amazon having a complete corner on the market. Yeah. I think it's bad for authors. I think KU is bad for authors.
Yeah.
And I don't think the downside is right now, the way that I set myself up, there's no way for me not to be in KU. Right. It's also a great way for authors to kickstart their careers, for new authors, to kind of get their name out there.
Yeah.
But I would encourage authors that if they're going to go and play around in KU, don't promise your readers that you'll put the whole thing in KU.
Yeah, let's avoid promises altogether.
Yeah, avoid promises as much as possible. But I do really like, I really like Kobo. I did really well with Kobo. And I wish I could be with them again. Because the thing I love about Kobo is like, that's all they do is books. They're not selling washing machines and laptops.
Right.
And t-shirts. They're just selling books. And I did really well with them. And I focused only on Canada and UK. I didn't focus on the United States at all for Kobo, and I did really well with them. And I built up quite a following too, because I worked it out. I'm like, if there are 10,000 science fiction readers in Canada and like 5,000 of them use Kobo, ebook readers, that's still a lot of people. Like, that's worth targeting, you know? So.
Yeah. You sell 5,000 books at almost any price and you're doing pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, and if I could read just a book a month, you're actually doing fantastic, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think like some of those smaller markets that these other retailers can reach are not to be dismissed. I know authors who make six figures on iTunes in Australia alone, you know. Yeah. So but if you're looking for something easy, KU is easier because you've only got to write ads that go to Amazon and whatnot, but you run the risk of trapping yourself in this Amazon ecosystem. So it's also different by genre too, to be honest.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of considerations to take.
It is a lot easier to go wide from the start. I mean, I recommend a lot of time that authors go to KU to at least get some money flowing and that sort of thing. But it's a lot easier long term to go wide from the start than to try to break out of KU.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Because basically, you build your audience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you start losing your income when you start edging books out of KU. Yeah.
And so, I kind of like. And that period, like I had some books around at KU for a year and a half, and it was so liberating. It's like, oh, I want to take this book and put it in a bundle, or I want to sell it, put it for free on my website. I can just do whatever I want with my damn book.
Right.
Where when you're in KU, you can't, you know.
What a concept. Do whatever you want with your own intellectual property. That is.
There's shocking. Also, by the way, a thing I'm super excited about. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called Bookshop.
Yes.
And that's like, that they're basically like kind of KU-ing print books in a way.
Yeah. So, okay. Now I have to, make sure that I go, because I keep meaning to go check that out. And well, that's it's definitely not bookshop.com, by the way.
No, it's bookshop.org, I think.
Yeah, .org. But I'll go back and check that out. I keep meaning to look. I keep reading about it, and I think it is going to be pretty great.
Yeah, it's all awesome.
Right. Well, we got another question here. Tori asks, with your high production rate, what is the average word count for your books?
It's about 70 to 80,000 words per book.
Okay, that's pretty average.
Yeah.
Do you do epics and all? I think you told me once you were, or you had.
My longer books are about 120 to 130.
Okay.
I probably only have about 15 books that long, but this fall I'm actually doing something new. I'm releasing a trilogy, and each book in the trilogy is going to be over 250,000 words.
Interesting.
Which is not a normal thing in science fiction. So I'm trying a new thing.
I'll be curious to hear how that works, especially the trilogy part. Cause you know, at first that's all I was writing were trilogies.
Mm-hmm.
And I gained some traction, but it never did kick over the same way the ongoing series did.
So yeah. I mean, my experience is different because this trilogy is the 7 plus 12 is really the 19 through 22nd books following this one character. So it's not like, because I always want to do things like I want to try and make, take an ongoing story, make it flow from the prior books, but also make it something that I can market as a new thing and have readers start there. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do with this. I want to start it in such a way that a reader could jump in there and be like, oh, this is really awesome. Now I want to go read the 19 books of backstory about this character.
So are you writing it in such a way that if you had to, you could break it out into individual novels instead of 230,000 words?
I haven't started yet, so who knows? I probably would. I probably could do that. I'll probably break it into large parts. So I'd imagine
That's exactly what I was thinking. You know, I've even thought about just taking, and I did an omnibus edition of my trilogy, and I think that people tend to buy that over the three books, probably because of the price. But it started making sense to me. Like, I think people just want to get. People were always complaining as I'd release one of those books that it wasn't a quote complete story. Yeah. They wanted to see the whole thing play out as if things like Star Wars had never existed or the Matrix trilogy.
I mean, like yeah, like Empire Strikes Back doesn't even have a full arc. Just ends with everybody in crap.
All the development happens in the first movie, and all the finishing everything off happens in the last movie. So it's a perfect middle chapter, though.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, and I actually I believe really strongly in omnibuses because it's a great way to take stuff you've already written and put it out in front of a new audience.
Yeah.
And when you do it, the word complete in the title is really important.
That's true.
Yeah. So when you write it, if it's a complete series, make sure you put complete in there because people will jump on that.
That's true. Yeah, that's a very good point. Do you do like bonus stuff, like short stories and things like that in your universe?
You mean like by doing omnibus?
Well, I was going to follow up by asking if you include that in an omnibus.
Yeah, I do. I probably have like maybe like 10 short stories that take place in my universe. And I also have a series of novellas as well, which I think has 10 novellas in it at this point.
Yeah.
I did take some of the short stories and write them to put in omnibuses. And what I found is my readers got pissed off. Because they're like, you know, I already bought this series. Now you're making me buy it again for a 10,000 word story. So I actually stopped doing that.
Yeah, I could see where that. Yeah, I could see that. I guess I would probably just do both. You know, like include it in the omnibus, but release it separately so people got.
Yeah, and that's what I end up doing. But I decided I might as well just release them separately because if I release them separately, I make more money. So that's what I just do now.
That's true. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, including short stories and things in the books. I mean, I tried that at first, and I found it didn't really benefit me at all. No, and I also find that I don't read that way, you know?
Yeah, a lot of times if I'm reading a big epic story, I want to know what's next. I don't want to take this detour.
You don't want to bite. Yeah, it's like giving you the appetizers after the meal.
Exactly, yeah.
Kevin Hearn, who wrote the Iron Druid series, the publishers, I'm sure, were the ones deciding to do this. They would include some of his short stories in that universe at the end of the books once they became popular. And I would start reading them, and they're not the same quality as the books.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it, too. It
threw me off because the editing team and everything, they're not doing the same work on those as they did on the novel.
Yeah.
So you can really see it is interesting to look at it from the perspective of you get to see – you know, where that author's weaknesses and strengths are actually.
Yeah. Mike Shepard, who's a pretty popular science fiction author, kind of went hybrid with his own series. I guess he had enough rights that he could actually write some of his own stuff, like short stories and novellas about his characters. Self-published them. And I think he underestimated the value that his publisher's editors were adding to his books because these things came out and they were full of typos and they weren't formatted nicely. And I think it hurt him a bunch actually when his readers sort of realized that, oh, you're not quite as good as we thought you were.
Oh, ouch, man. That ouch.
Yeah, that's a lot of ouch.
Yeah, that is a lot of ouch. So we're kind of getting close to wrapping up. We got a couple minutes. Was there, you got anything on the board coming up besides your epic trilogy? You got new stuff coming out soon?
I mean, I'm doing some fun stuff. One of them is I'm actually the lead writer for a video game called Destiny Sword. And it's an indie video game. And we're still working on getting a lot of our funding together. But we actually will have an alpha out, playable alpha pretty soon. And I've already played it myself. And it's pretty freaking awesome. It's a ton of fun.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. It's kind of like if XCOM was an MMO. and stuff like that. So, and yet it's really neat too, because it actually deals with trauma in a real way. So your characters get PTSD if you use them too much, and they get injuries and they become less effective. And it's actually like it's a military game where you actually have to like treat your military like they're real people.
People are actual expendable assets.
I know, right? It's crazy.
I guess expendable is not the right term.
No, they're not expendable is what they are.
Yeah, they're not expendable. So that's really interesting. I mean, I wish you had mentioned that about 30 minutes ago so we could go into that
came out in February, and we're probably gonna do a couple more. And we're doing neat things with that too, because we're gonna have these global events that are gonna take place in the game. And if your character does well, your character will actually end up in the next book, because every global event's gonna have a book written about it, that what happened and the conflict and stuff like that. So
that is amazing. We're gonna definitely have to chat again, you and I, about how that came about.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of authors, and I know some authors who've written for video games, like Justin Sloan. That was his career for a while, but it's something we're all interested in.
Yeah, totally.
I got two
more things if you want, two more interesting things I'm doing. I can go fast.
Go real fast, because we're at 12:45. Go ahead.
I did a Kickstarter that funded the narration of an entire series before I had to get it done. So rather than trying to catch it up on the other side, I got that. I got $11,000 on a Kickstarter.
Nice.
And I'm also doing some books with Atheon Publishing, where we're going to do the simultaneous release of ebook, print, and audio. All through Audible. So that's some fun stuff too. That's just stuff I do to diversify income and make sure try and
get is that on your places. You got stuff about that on your website?
No, I don't actually, not yet.
Oh, bad marketer. Bad marketer. Well,
they're running the pre-order at 99¢, and I want to make money, so I'm not telling anyone to buy
it. Oh, I understand. No, I understand. Man, ouch. Okay. Everyone watching, I'm sure there will be some news about that stuff at Aeon14.com eventually. So pop on over. And Mal, man, thank you so much for being a part of the broadcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great being on.
All right. We'll have you on again, I'm sure. So
Everyone
else, as you're watching, make sure, no matter where you are, pop on over to YouTube and subscribe to our YouTube channel over there. That helps us out quite a bit. You'll be alerted when new DDD spotlights and other stuff go live. So pop over there. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/digital. There, be sure to bookmark DDD Live so that you can see a little fancy countdown and get some information on when these are going live next and see all the past DDD spotlights. All that stuff is available at DDD Live, so make sure you pop on over there. And thank you once again, Mal, for keeping me occupied for 45 minutes.
It was great being on.
All right, everybody. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to have another one of these with another guest, so we'll see you there. That's it for this week's Self-Publishing Insiders with Draft to Digital. Be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with your will-be author friends. And start, build, and grow your own self-publishing career right now at drafttodigital.com.